Hey guys, it's time to talk to you about the boatload of money you can make this week betting at MyBookie. If you haven't checked them out, this is the perfect time to get into the action because the madness of March is here. If you lay down some money and score big on college hoops, you could join me and thousands of others and start betting right now at MyBookie.ag. MyBookie is great because there's no runaround when you ask for a payout. And I would only recommend a service that's been good to me and our listeners. That's why I urge you to make your way to MyBookie, because when you win, they pay, and that's fast without any hassles. You're wasting your time betting anywhere else. And MyBookie even has in-game live betting, so you can place a bet right after tip-off. So if you're at work and you need to make a last-minute bet on a game, you can do that on MyBookie. So right now, join MyBookie, and they'll match your first deposit with a 50% bonus. And you can even enter for a chance to win their $1 million bracket challenge. Use the promo code LOCKEDONNBA to activate that offer. Visit MyBookie today. Use that promo code LOCKEDONNBA. Play, win, and get paid.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello and welcome to the Locked On Cavaliers podcast, your daily look at LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. I'm Chris Manning, your host and the site manager at SB Nation's Fear of the Sword. On today's show, I'm joined by Chris Stone, who covers the draft and college hoops for places like the Sporting News. And the Step Back is my guest. Chris, how are you?
I'm doing really good. Excited to be here and talk a little bit about the draft ahead of the NCAA tournament.
And for the five people on Twitter that know this, it's another Team Chris team up, which is Chris Barnwell has been in the show, and now we got Chris Stone, and it's more Chris's the better.
Absolutely.
So we're going to, obviously, as Chris alluded to, we're going to talk about the draft. The Cavs, with that Nets pick, are going to have the chance to get somebody good in this draft, or get somebody to then trade for somebody else if that's what they decide to do, if LeBron stays. So much up in the air, but who could be available? It depends on where it is. It depends on who falls, who rises. It's so early to say, but for NBA fans, at least for me, watching the tournament to get a look at some of these guys that I haven't had a chance to watch is one of the most important things. If you want to check out Chris's draft work, specifically his current big board, there's a link to that in the show notes. You link to it if you're listening to it at For the Sword, and you'll see his rankings. Number one currently is Luka Doncic, the prospect who I personally love plays in Europe. And there's a lot of other names. We're going to go region by region, talk about some of these guys. But Chris, before we do that, anything in the brackets you stand out as like a game or a team that you're kind of like, oh, I'm interested to see how that little storyline plays out among this bigger, more complicated storyline?
Yeah, I mean, the most exciting things to look for are the potential prospect matchups that come up down the line. There's not necessarily a ton of super intriguing matchups in the first round beyond, you know, highly touted NBA prospect versus experienced and good college player that can prove illuminating in some ways. But the matchups that I think everybody really wants to see are when the best prospects play the best prospects. And in that sense, the kind of bottom half of the Midwest region is particularly intriguing because there's a potential Sweet 16 matchup between Michigan State and Duke, which would give us an opportunity to see Jaren Jackson versus Marvin Bagley for a second time. And this time, hopefully Marvin Bagley wouldn't get poked in the eye. The first time they played, he only played 10 minutes because he got hurt. And so that's kind of the matchup that I think everybody's hoping actually happens, just given the quantity of prospects that would be in that game.
We're going to start up in the West with Mizzou, who's an 8 seed against Florida State. Now, the headline guy here is Michael Porter Jr. He just came back from an injury, played one game, and they lost that game in the NCAA tournament after he'd missed the entire season with a back injury. Chris, how did he look in that game? If you look at his box score, it was not great. That's all you saw. If you watched it like you did, and you know I did as a more casual observer, it wasn't great. And what do you think the chances are that as we're evaluating him and someone who that maybe some people have talked about as being the number one pick before he started college, is there a chance we actually get an extended look at where he's at right now?
So against Georgia, he looked pretty terrible. He certainly looked like somebody who hadn't played basketball for 3 months or however many months it was. He finished with 12 points. He was 5 of 17 from the field. He took a really awful three-pointer towards the end of the game when Missouri had a chance to tie or take the lead, I believe. And he just kind of didn't look like he was in rhythm. One of the difficult things, obviously, of fitting a player like Porter back into your lineup is that he requires a lot of particular things to happen on the offensive end because he likes to kind of isolate, take his time. He's not necessarily a ball mover, and he tends to catch the ball in kind of these mid-range spots where he can go to work. It's a lot similar to kind of how Jason Tatum was at Duke last year. And obviously that's not how Jason Tatum plays this year, but as a prospect, that's kind of what we thought of them. And they're a little bit similar in that regard. Porter clearly doesn't have his explosion back yet, but he's still 6'10", can elevate over most of the defenders in college basketball. But, you know, he looked a step slow defensively and wasn't integrated well on the offensive end. Now, I do think we're probably going to get an extended look at him coming up. Obviously, I don't know that Missouri is going to win that many games in the NCAA tournament, but in their opening round game against Florida State, their starting small forward, Jordan Barnett, is suspended because he got a DUI last weekend. So Missouri currently has an opening at the starting small forward spot, which it would seem likely that Michael Porter Jr. slots into. Obviously, all of that's contingent on his conditioning and being in shape. But I do think we're probably going to get a pretty lengthy look at him in that game, given he played 23 minutes against Georgia last weekend.
What would you want to see from him? Let's say he just gets the one game. Let's just say he only ends up getting the one NCAA tournament game, and he goes into likely declaring for the draft with two college games under his belt and a whole bunch more missed because of a back injury. It's obviously like way too much to put on one game to determine what kind of prospect he should be, and he hasn't exactly fallen off the draft board because of this injury, but what if you're looking for him to rebound from that bad first game back, what would you want to see from him?
The thing that worries me the most about him is some of the stuff that worried me the most about Jason Tatum too, which is that isolation heavy play style. I think it'd be really nice to see him fit in more consistently with the offense. Obviously, we already know that he can go get his own shot and make really tough shots against defenses. We saw him do that before the season. He played in a scrimmage against Kansas, and he did some of the same things. And we obviously saw it in high school. And so I want to see him just kind of play within the flow of the offense, move the ball around. Missouri has a number of good shooters. His brother is a nice shooter from one of the big spots for Missouri. And I just think that seeing him work in that team environment would be a big step forward to seeing what we could potentially get out of him in the NBA.
I am very, very intrigued by just that game, just because it's so weird that it's weird that he's coming back, because again, he's not conversation for the number one pick at this point, but it wasn't as if he went from lottery pick to late first round pick or something. It's not like this guy is going to lose the sort of guaranteed security money you get from being a lottery pick. And it doesn't seem as if, I mean, he hasn't, I guess, said anything as far as I know, but it doesn't seem also like he's going to go back to college just based on this. Like, he's going to the draft, it very much seems like. And it's going to be really interesting to me to just see, like, if he has, like, a really big game, even if they lose. I just wonder if that buys him some kind of narrative, if that propels him in some way that we just can't know until he, you know, maybe drops 30 points or something.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I certainly think he was probably benefiting from some of the mystique that existed around him based on, you know, having not played and everybody's memory being this dominant high school player. But truthfully, I think that this is a situation where it was important for him to play for Missouri because it was the last opportunity to play with his brother. His dad's an assistant coach there. His aunt, I believe, coaches the women's team there. Both of his sisters played for the women's team there. So there's kind of a lot of familial stuff going on. And I think he really just wanted to play basketball for Missouri. And I think if he had the opportunity, he probably would have played earlier so that he could get a home game in and play in Columbia or whatever. But, you know, I don't think it's going to be possible for him to drop out of, you know, the top seven picks, for example. So I don't think he's putting a ton at risk other than obviously some potential health stuff. But if his doctors say he's good to go, then it's probably okay. And maybe he plays himself up a spot or two in that early lottery.
Moving on in this region is the number two seed, Arizona. He's in that they feature DeAndre Ayton, who has, you know, been not just one of the most talked about prospects, but has been in the news a lot recently. He's number five on your board. That's behind Marvin Bagley III. So when you look at him and you look at the position he's going to be in, is maybe having a chance to make a tournament run with Arizona. Is there anything he could do that would cause him to jump from five up into, let's say, the top three or push for number one, where a lot of people seem to have him above guys like Doncic and a guy like Bagley?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest question with DeAndre Ayton at this point is what he can give you on the defensive end of the floor. I think that at this point, everybody understands that he's a dominant interior offensive player in college basketball. He's like 7'1", 260 pounds. He literally looks like Joel Embiid already in terms of his like physical frame. And relative to all of the college players that he's playing against who are significantly smaller than him, he's just totally dominant, you know, scoring in the post and on the boards. But there are some serious questions about where he fits defensively. He's only averaging 2.3 blocks per 40 minutes, which is, to give you some perspective, kind of on par with what Justin Patton averaged last year. And I don't think that anybody ever thought of him as kind of the lockdown interior rim protector at the NBA level. I think Ayton struggles a little bit in terms of grasping concepts of team defense. He doesn't always get in the right place when he's defending pick and rolls. He doesn't always rotate over from the weak side. There are flashes and examples of that thing occurring. And he's obviously a really good one-on-one defender because he can slide on the perimeter and has length. And that just dominates so many of the college opponents. But it's not clear that he has this grasp on defense that would allow him to kind of anchor an NBA defense at the next level. And so I think that's the thing that I'm probably looking forward to the most, is just being able to see that, because we know so many of the other things are definitely true, that those things aren't a concern anymore. We know he can shoot in the mid-range. We know he can pick and pop, occasionally knock down a three-pointer. We know he can crush the offensive glass and score on the post-ups, but it's not clear what he brings defensively. And I think that when we're talking about how bigs translate to the NBA level, that's super important.
Just based on where, how many games he reasonably could play, I mean, it's just like, it's functionally a handful of games. It's going to be a small sample size of numbers. Is it at all reasonable to for him to go into this tournament and, let's say, just have, like, look really good and that be enough to quell some doubts? Or is this just his chance is like a last big audition before the combine? Because, I mean, this will, for a lot of these guys, it's worth noting, will be the last time they play organized basketball on a competitive scale until summer league, right? Like, it's like there'll be some drills and stuff at the combine, but it's not as if they go from this and are playing in like a in a pre-NBA league or getting some G League reps. Like, this is the last thing before they get drafted and then go into summer league play.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And with Ayton, I wouldn't necessarily say that it's about particular numbers that he puts up in the NCAA tournament so much as it is seeing what he does on the film. When, you know, balls come into the post and his the other defender is out of the post, does he rotate over? When guards drive and he's down low, does he rotate over? There's obviously some questions because he tends to play kind of the power forward spot for Arizona that pulls him out away from the basket in some situations. But even when he's down there, he's not necessarily making those rotations. And so I think those are the types of things we'll be watching for with DeAndre Ayton. And there's a potential matchup that he has with Kentucky, I think, in the second round that could put them, you know, put him up against a number of other NBA prospects, and I think that that could be particularly interesting.
Another center in this region is Mo Bamba. He's playing for number 10 Texas against the number 17 Nevada. He's a little bit lower on your board, I think, at the back end of the lottery, or like at least back end of the top 10. Where does he stand for you entering the tournament? And like for as long as he is, and for all the freak potential he seems to have, why is he behind Bagley and Ayton for you?
Sure. So Bamba's returning from a toe injury, and he hasn't played the last couple of years, but he should be ready to go, or last couple of games, not years. But he should be ready to go against Nevada, which will be a super interesting matchup for him. Nevada basically doesn't play any traditional big man. They play a bunch of guards and combo forwards, and they like to shoot a ton of threes. So that's going to be intriguing. The thing with Bamba that scares me a lot, and everybody talks about the 7'9" wingspan, the ability to block all of the shots. He's a great rim protector. All of that is true, and he has some lateral mobility, and there's a chance that he could anchor an NBA defense one day. But I have some serious questions about what we've seen in terms of his offensive game and its progression over the course of the year. So we're talking about someone who's 6'11", with a 7'9" wingspan, and he still ranks in the 35th percentile scoring on post-ups against college competition. That's atrocious. And then, you know, you would think, well, okay, this guy's a 7'9" wingspan. Maybe he can be a vertical floor spacer and roll out of the pick and roll and destroy kind of just rim running. Well, he's 20th percentile in the pick and roll because he has a tendency to pop out to the three-point line and launch terrible percentage threes. And he's only 6'9" when he rolls to the basket, which is 29th percentile in college basketball. So he's not using any of his physical tools on the offensive end. And we haven't really seen him improve that portion of his game over the course of the season. So I think there's some real questions about what you can get out of him as a ceiling outcome. Like, if he's not Rudy Gobert defensively, and let's be honest, like, he's probably not Rudy Gobert defensively, then what are you getting out of him on the offensive end of the ball that makes up that gap? And I'm not sure we've seen enough from him that suggests that there will be, you know, something there to do that.
with him coming off that injury, and with just, again, like the same factor that every guy's thinking, that they could just have a few minute games, is there anything he can do really in this tournament that would be significant for him as a prospect? Is there anything he could do in one game or in a couple games if Texas advances past beyond what you would think they would as a 10 seed? Is there anything he could reasonably do that would buck him up, maybe not to the top five, but at least on the fringe of it, more so than closer to 10 in the back end of that lottery?
I think it's mostly just making sure he doesn't hurt himself in this game against Nevada. I don't know that there's necessarily something he can do against him that would push him up, because if he goes in, you know, like I said, 6'11", 7'9", wingspan, and dominates Nevada's 6'7" center, I don't think that necessarily pushes him up the board, but that's something he should be capable of doing given the size advantage that he has. And if he doesn't do that, it's going to call into question, you know, the same things that I was just talking about, his ability to progress and do things on the offensive end.
Moving on out of that bracket, you go up to the East, where we have Villanova as a one seed, and they're led by your number seven prospect, Mikal or Michael. I don't know if it's Mikal or Michael Bridges.
Mikal
Bridges. What should people who are going to see him for the first time, and assumedly in a long stretch, assuming a Villanova plays up to the level they seem capable of playing as a one seed, what should people be looking for? And because for me, when you look at where that Nets pick just seems like it could end up, if the Nets just aren't as bad as some of their tanking teams, he seems like a guy that's going to be available, and along with Bamba, is going to be more available in this range than an Ayton or Marvin Bagley, who we're going to get to, might be.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like Mikal Bridges, and he's someone who it wouldn't surprise me if he actually goes number seven or in that range, because he's such a perfect fit for the modern NBA. Bridges is kind of a certified 3-and-D prospect, averages 2 steals, 1.4 blocks per 40, shoots better than 40% from behind the arc. That alone is super intriguing. He doesn't handle the ball very much, though, and so kind of the two things that I'm really interested in the NCAA tournament and following are whether or not he can shoot off of movement, because that would improve his ceiling as a 3-and-D guy, right? He wouldn't just be kind of the dangerous spot-up shooter. He's 90th percentile this season shooting off of screens, but it's obviously on a low number of attempts. But hopefully we'll get to see some more of that throughout the NCAA tournament, whether it's flare screens, down screens, etc., just like a little bit more off of movement. And then the other question is whether or not he'll get any additional creation opportunities. He doesn't actually handle the ball very much for Villanova. That goes to their junior point guard, Jalen Brunson. And so far, we've kind of only seen Bridges in straight line drives, but he occasionally shows flashes of being able to shoot off the dribble or, you know, put on a little bit of a move to get to the basket, whether it's a Euro step or something there. So those flashes of creation and shooting off of movement are the things that you're looking for that could kind of raise his ceiling. But I think we already know that he's a legitimate 3-and-D prospect for the NBA.
When you look at evaluating a guy like that, that you're saying, okay, that he's not the primary ball handler, and so we sort of what he does is obviously very valuable, and you describe it as a modern NBA fit, but is it harder to evaluate a guy that's going to be a lottery pick and might have some expectation of having the ball in his hands as an NBA player? And of course, if he's on the Cavs and LeBron's back, that's a whole other story, but like, is it harder to evaluate a guy, and for you as someone who, this is what you do, When you don't see a guy that just has the ball in his hands as much, like, how do you go about evaluating a guy that's not just forcing himself into your view when you're watching a game?
Yeah, Bridges is a really interesting prospect in my mind, because typically when we talk about guys who became 3-and-D players in the NBA, they were kind of your college superstars who, you know, fell into that role once they got into the NBA. But with Bridges, we're talking about someone who is a bona fide 3-and-D player already. And so I think the fact that Bridges is so high on draft boards right now is a reflection of what the NBA needs, right? If you got someone who was up for a contract this year that you knew was an obviously versatile defender who could create defensive events and definitely shoot 40% while shooting a little bit off of movement, that dude would get a huge contract, right? And so Bridges is difficult to evaluate because we don't necessarily know what his ceiling is in terms of creation, but we know that he's probably going to be an A-plus role player in the NBA. And I don't really think that's usually how these players come about.
Yeah, I think you're dead on about that. We don't really see guys that, at least, and I think for teams in the lottery, I think sometimes we do see a without having data points to specifically say, okay, this is like proof of that. I think teams do tend to think, okay, can I get a higher upside guy at this point? Because maybe Bridges is never your franchise guy, but if he's really, really good and he's your third best player, is that a bad thing to get in number seven? I would say no, right? Like, if you can get a guy that's actually going to play for you for 10 years, that seems like a good thing. That seems better than taking someone who is you're going to have to take 3 years to develop and then they don't work out.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Also in the East, Colin Sexton, the number 13 prospect, he's playing for 9-seed Alabama. He's, to me, we talked about this right before we started recording, but he's someone that I'm more interested in now just because you talk about how Trae Young hasn't played very well. But is he someone who, and he's your number 13 prospect based on your last big board. Is Sexton someone who could get himself up higher and maybe become that top point guard or on the fringes of being that top point guard? If he has a really good tournament and maybe takes Alabama, you know, at least like a game or two in, is there anything he could do that could bump him up above like someone like Trae Young?
Yeah, and I think that progress has already started. As soon as I released my big board, he had this insane SEC tournament where he put up like 25 a game and hit a game winner against Texas A&M. So I just kind of figured that he read it and wanted to make me look stupid. But I think that there is a chance that he becomes the top point guard prospect back in this class. He's had a terrific start to March. He's averaging nearly 30 points per 40 minutes over four games during that stretch. The big question with him is whether or not his three-point shooting comes along and if the shot's going to be consistent. He's shooting 34% from three right now. Well, we know that when he's not shooting well, that puts him in some difficult positions. We saw what happened during February when he wasn't shooting well, and that's what caused him to slide down my big board in particular, because I think in the NBA, if your lead ball handler has shooting questions, you kind of have a ceiling on your offensive outcome. But if Sexton is knocking down threes at a consistent basis, like he is this month when he's shooting 50%, which obviously isn't sustainable, but we get to kind of see what he can do when there's threat of that jumper and teams are closing out quicker and playing him tighter, because he does have this terrific change of pace game that allows him to get to the rim at a really high rate. And so I think kind of if he can show that the shot is a little bit more consistent during March, that'll move him up. If he can show that he can be a consistently good passer during March, that'll move him up. But he's someone who, even since I released my big board, is probably someone that I would move up based on his performances in March already.
How do you, I mean, just, we're going to get to Trae Young in the next thing, at least a little bit. We might as well just talk about him now. What's, they're obviously very different and they have different body types. They've had different types of seasons, but what separates the two for you? Like what is there an actual big difference of them as a prospect? Is there something that you like about one guy more than the other that in your personal view on these guys that puts them in a different category?
The biggest thing to me is that Trae Young, at least early on, was a definite high quality 3-point shooter. He's down to 36% on the year this season, but he's shooting 10 attempts per game. So we know he's taking a ton of attempts. He's taking a ton of really tough attempts. He basically gets no shots off the catch for Oklahoma because he's their only creator and the only person really on the team, honestly, who can dribble. And so I think we can expect to see that 3-point percentage come up once he gets into the league and gets to take a few less difficult shots. But Trae, to me, is the type of prospect who has the legitimate ability to launch from well behind the 3-point line. He has the potential to be kind of an offensive gravitational force that opens up some of the spacing in ways that Colin Sexton doesn't, because he has those questions about shooting. So it's really just Trae's ability to shoot is more important in the modern NBA than Sexton's ability to get to the rim.
Moving on up to the Midwest, three of your top guys are there. Marvin Bagley and Wendell Carter, both, I think, of the top 10. Bagley right up and near the top are with number 2 seed Duke. You have Trae Young, who we talked about, and with number 10 seed Oklahoma. And then you have both Jaren Jackson Jr. and Miles Bridges with number 3 Michigan State. We're going to get to all three, but is there one particular guy, or in certain cases, I mean, it's one team and those guys' roles on their team that you would like to start with? Which one of these three to you is the most interesting thing you're looking for as we get and start watching March Madness?
I moved Jaren Jackson up to number 2 on my board in my recent update, which I think is a little bit contrary to conventional wisdom. A large part of that is just that I think he's the most kind of has the most NBA ready skill set. We talk so much about big man unicorns, obviously, who can block shots and shoot threes. And Jaren Jackson is the person among the best bigs in this class who most likely is going to be able to do both of those things. He has the best defensive instincts of any big in the class, even though he's playing the four. So when people refer to DeAndre Ayton and Marvin Bagley not getting blocked shots because they're also playing the four, it's kind of just like, well, Jaren Jackson averages like 5 blocked shots per 40 minutes. Why isn't he finding those shots, or what's different about him than those two? And I think it's that he just has better defensive instincts. He moves really well. Jackson also has some three-point upside. I want to say he's shooting in the high 30s right now from deep. He has a bit of a funky shot with kind of a weird release, and it's flat, but he shot it well from deep since high school, and so that's intriguing. And then the other thing is, he's one of the youngest prospects in the class, but he's already shown quite a bit of skill development this year, particularly as a ball handler. So in that big board update, I wrote a little bit about the progressions he's made, kind of attacking closeouts and even flashing the occasional advanced dribble move, which is absurd for someone who's 6'11 and 18 years old.
So you look at Jaren Jackson. Why for you? I think it's like a lot of people have Aiden, have Bagley up there a little bit higher. Why is Jackson for you risen so far? Is it because he's like fits the NBA now really well? Is it just something like what factors have pushed him up your big board?
I think a lot of it does have to do with the way that he would fit the modern NBA. In particular, I think his ability to shoot the three is a little bit more defined than Bagley and Ayton. The other thing that I think is really important is he just seems most prepared to anchor an NBA defense in terms of his ability to protect the rim. I think he's obviously going to have to put on some strength. He's probably not going to contribute immediately, but he has that particular upside because he has the instincts that the other guys don't necessarily have.
Looking at the Duke guys, you have Bagley and you have Carter. Carter would be, Nets pick fell way back for whatever reason, that would be someone that seems more in play. But Bagley, depending on how high they pick, could be someone that's there. I know he's not super high. He's not the highest in the draft board. He's number, I think, 5 or 6 in the SB Nation mock draft that just went up. Where is he? And just how do you feel about him in comparison to the other guys? Like, do you have this? Some of the concerns I've seen about him is that he is just not, like, the defensive problems are maybe there. He just doesn't seem to wow people for some reason. And there's the way some of these other guys do, like Ayton seems to for some people. What for you do you just feel about Bagley?
Yeah, so I have Bagley 3rd on my board, which I think is generally higher than other people do. And a large part of that just has to do with kind of an intersection of his athleticism and his motor. Both of those things combined allow him to take over games in ways that some of these other prospects don't. He destroys people on the offensive glass. He's, you know, is the quickest to the ball in a lot of situations on the offensive end. He's a terrific roll man out of ball screens. Great finisher there. The last time I checked, he was 10 for 10 on those possessions. Now, you have to kind of understand, like, these guys don't get a ton of chances to run pick and roll ball screens where they're diving to the basket. Like, that just doesn't exist. But he has great footwork, great hands in those situations. The reason that I like Bagley a little bit more than Ayton is that there are just some small things that I think he checks the box on a little bit more than Ayton does. I think he has a little bit more playmaking ability off the bounce. He's occasionally shown some passing on the move, whether it be from isolation settings or on short rolls. And I think that fits the modern game a little bit better than just kind of a strict post-up game. Ayton's passing shines. I also think that Bagley has some upside as a shooter. He's shooting 37% from three. There's some questions, I think, about how that's going to translate because his free throw numbers are pretty bad, but he's always shot like kind of around average from three. And then I just think that he has a lot more upside being able to handle the ball than some of these guys do. Jaren Jackson obviously is someone who I just talked about who's done some of that, but Bagley has that same ability, just not to the same level of the advanced dribble moves that Jackson has. So I just think a lot of the little things about Bagley, the passing on the move, the ability to take over games with his athleticism, fit better in the modern NBA than some of the guys who I have behind them.
Looking at young Trae Young again for a second, he's had, mm-hmm. I mean, he had that blistering start, was just insanely doing everything well and rose way up, kind of came out of nowhere, it seemed like. He hasn't, played as well, and in some of the stuff I've read about the Oklahoma that they maybe shouldn't have gotten. And does he have to like have at least one really good game to just kind of normalize him as he heads out? Because it seems like he's in a position to go no matter what. But does he have to do something good to just kind of get back to at least some of the hype that he had, or is that just a misreading on my part?
No. I think that's exactly right. I mean, he's going to play Rhode Island in the opening round. Their starting point guard is Jared Terrell, who's like a 215-pound senior who's going to like really get up into Trae Young. So it's going to be a super interesting matchup, but I think we need to see him deliver something that resembles old Trae Young. Since the start of February, he's shooting about 25% from the three-point line. He's kind of made these excuses that he's been fatigued, but now he's had a week off since the last time he's played a basketball game. And the kid is super talented, but it's kind of not clear that he's fully engaged right now and that he wants to be there. I mean, I've kind of been joking lately that he has some real Isaiah Thomas equity on the defensive end because he just doesn't have the size to not try, and he doesn't try, or at least over the last 6 weeks he hasn't been trying, and that's a super scary thing. So I do think he needs to kind of have a big game in the NCAA tournament. Otherwise, I think that there's a good chance he's not the top point guard prospect on the board come June, because people just aren't going to be certain about what they're getting. A lot of the things that have happened over the last 6 weeks are criticisms that existed about him coming out of high school. And he blew those doors off when he got to college and was shooting 40% from three and bombing 28 footers. But now those things have kind of come back, and I think are at the forefront of people's minds.
You saying the Isaiah defensive comparison has me running in the other direction. Like, like if I had a draft board up right now, I'd be I think that just makes me want to cross him all the way off. And that's like probably a little harsh, but I hear that and I'm like, oh, I don't know. I just, that's really tough. That's just, it's like Isaiah for how good he was at Boston. Sure, it's really hard to build a defense with a guy that plays that way. It's just really hard.
And what's weird is I think Trey can be better than that when he's engaged, because he does have some of the we always talked about Lonzo Ball as a bad defender last year, but in reality, he's a pretty decent team defender because he's a ball hawk in passing lanes and stuff. And Trey has some of those smarts. He doesn't have the same length that Lonzo does, but he can affect the game in similar ways when he's engaged by getting into passing lanes, disrupting, kind of digging down on post guys, etc. But he's just not doing that right now. And whether it's fatigue or he just doesn't want to be there or whatever, it's something that I want to see out of him when he plays Rhode Island, is just a bit more engagement.
That's a fascinating thing. I'm gonna be thinking about that now and up until he gets drafted somewhere. Like, that's just gonna be that what you just said about that's gonna like stick in my brain. Is there a player or a team that you're bummed that they miss the tournament because it means you're gonna be losing less time evaluating one guy or a group of guys? Is there anyone that's lottery wise or just deep into the second round flyers that just you're bummed you're not gonna get more of a chance to evaluate them?
So Troy Brown is the highest ranking player on my board who missed the tournament, but he'll play in the NIT, so there'll be some opportunity to watch him there. Boise State's Chandler Hutchinson is one I would have been interested to see in the NCAA tournament. 6'7" wing, decent shooter, can attack off the catch, make some plays, both passing and getting to the rim. The reason that I think it would have been interesting to see him in the NCAA tournament would just be an opportunity to watch him against some kind of more quality competition, since he plays out, I believe, in the Mountain West. But obviously we're not going to get that chance now, and we'll have to kind of wait until probably the combine, really, to see him play against quality opponents. And so that's probably the one that I'm most bummed about.
Is there a team with an underrated prospect you think people need to watch and just make sure they keep an eye on? Is there anyone like that just fits, like, okay, this guy might not be a first round pick or at least an early first round pick, but he might be a really good NBA player, and this is the time to get familiar with him?
Sure. So I'm a Kansas grad, and this is a bit of a homer pick, but I'm okay with that. Devontae Graham is a point guard out of Kansas who took over the role from Frank Mason this year. He played alongside him last year, and he's someone who I think over the last probably month has really risen up my board as a potential backup option in the NBA. He's 85th percentile as a pick and roll ball handler. He's 80th percentile on pull-ups, and he's 93rd percentile on catch and shoots. He has a slight frame, but he gets to the foul line at a high rate, and he's a defender who really competes. A couple years ago when he was a sophomore, he did a lot of work against Buddy Hield, against them when they played in Oklahoma, and he kind of looked like he would be the person to take over the point guard spot for Kansas. And then Frank Mason just like had his breakout season, and Graham took kind of a back seat. But I think Graham is someone who could come in. He's 23 years old already, so like he's not a high upside play, but he is someone who I think could contribute right away as a big shot maker, both on and off the ball. And who will try defensively against pretty much everybody on the court. And so he's someone who I think is really interesting.
Looking at the Cavs right now, is there a guy that's at the top of the draft that you're like, okay, this guy might fit really well in the LeBron stays category and in the LeBron leaves category? Are they the same guy, or do you see different factors contributing to who might actually be a really good fit?
Well, given how much LeBron likes to have the ball in his hands, I think that they probably are different categories. In the place where they're going to be picking, I really like Mikal Bridges for them, because I think he would just fit really well with what LeBron does. He's going to give them a versatile defender who doesn't take up too many possessions on offense and can just spot up and run off of screens and get shots up that way. And that's how he'll generate his usage. but he'll still bring value on the defensive end no matter what. So if LeBron stays, I kind of think Mikal Bridges is the perfect fit there. If LeBron leaves, basically everyone's in play, right? You just kind of want to grab the highest upside play that I think you can grab, whether that's a Michael Porter Jr., a Wendell Carter, just kind of depending on who's available. I will say that if I were in a situation where LeBron left, I don't know that Mohamed Bamba would be my play. And honestly, I don't know that Mohamed Bamba would be my play if LeBron stayed, because he's not going to be ready to contribute right away. And I think he just is going to need a better environment than, you know, a team that's in a full rebuild mode, or a pretty heavy rebuild mode at least.
Yeah, Porter fascinates me because I wonder if they look at that guy as someone that they could turn into a really nice complimentary scorer and just kind of have him do that from day one. I just wonder if that becomes like really, really appetizing for them. You know, I just that to me just seems like if they feel like his health's good, and even if he doesn't, I mean, you could see it depending on where they pick and the upside of him. I feel like they might look at him and say, okay, we have Jetty Osmond who can do these couple things defense effort wise. Maybe we should take the chance on the score. I wonder if that fits into their calculus at all. And that's kind of, that makes me wonder if they're going to pay a lot of attention. We know that they've at least looked at Colin Sexton, and I'm sure they've scouted all pretty much everybody. I know they've scouted Trae Young too, but I wonder if Porter just intrigues me for so many reasons, just because not just his story, but if he can be something of resembling that terror that you see on the clips, which admittedly are sometimes against these like really tiny high school players he was just yamming on. I wonder if there's just something there that could be really interesting mining next to LeBron. I don't know. That's just where I stand on it.
Yeah, no, I like that pick for them. And I think if they're closer to 5 than 10, then that pick makes a lot of sense. If they're closer to 10 than 5, then Porter's probably going to be off the board. But I do think that Porter makes a lot of sense there. And the one thing about Porter is he kind of sets you up in the best of both worlds situation, right? Where if he plays with LeBron, he can sort of be the 3-and-D guy. And I think his defense is better than most people would guess. And if LeBron leaves, then you can kind of groom him into being the primary scoring option and hope that he's kind of the next high upside superstar play. So I certainly agree with your assessment there.
Wrap it up on this. Why is Luka Doncic number one on your board? The one guy that we're not going to get to see, I think he's just dealing with an injury right now over in Europe, playing with ex-Cav Eddie Tavares, funnily enough. But why is he number one? Like, and Jackson Bagley, whoever. Is there a scenario you could see you dropping him from your number one spot between now and June?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a scenario. He had a really rough February, and if that kind of stuff continues or somebody plays their way into that slot, then I certainly think there's a scenario where he comes off of the one line for me. But the thing that gets me is that he's just such a perfect fit with everything that the modern NBA needs. He's a good shooter. Obviously, his percentages aren't that great, but his projectable numbers are quite good. He can shoot it off the bounce. He can shoot it off the catch. He's a versatile playmaker on the offensive end who can handle the ball. He's big enough to guard multiple positions defensively. And then it all comes back to this production that is happening in the second best league in the world against grown men, as this 18-year-old is putting up historic numbers. And we've already seen him do it against NBA competition in Eurobasket. And so all of those things combined just make him the best prospect in the draft to me, because he has this level of production as well as a bit of potential that I don't know that anybody else can match.
Tournament's going to be fascinating. This whole process is going to be fascinating. I have more fun covering the NBA when it's part of a team's calculus, and it seems like they're actually going to do something serious and not just kind of write off their picks. But you should definitely be following Chris through this whole time. You can find him on Twitter at CStoneHoops. Chris, you can find your writing. Let's see, Rush the Court, The Step Back, The Sporting News, and I think I'm missing one.
I do some college basketball work for FanSided as well.
Yeah, so check out all his work, all those places. And Chris, thanks so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
If you have mailbag questions, Locked On Cavs listeners, we'll do one later this week. Get those to lockedoncavs@gmail.com. Go on iTunes. 5-star rating and reviews are the best way to support the podcast. Find me on Twitter at CWMWrites. Find the pod on Twitter and Facebook at Locked On Cavs. Be checking out Locked On NBA as well, Monday through Friday. And we'll be back tomorrow with a recap of Cavs Suns. And we'll talk to you again Wednesday.